This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Living life as a transgendered adult carries its own set of issues and challenges, and society seems to slowly be opening up to accommodate and even celebrate these people. But most trans adults were once growing up as a trans child who needed a lot of support.
The majority of trans kids are invisible because they don't feel safe to show themselves. Even in school districts that have trans-inclusive policies, they're still very much organized around the two-sex system.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the children and parents who make up the current trans generation. We'll also spend an academic minute exploring how Americans feel about transgender rights. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. To say that a child growing up questioning their gender is a new thing would be terribly naive, but the fact that these children are becoming part of the national conversation is a fairly new development. Not that the conversation has always been supportive, but it is happening. From daycare to birthday parties and from the playground to the school bathroom, trans kids regularly experience difficulty as a result of the restrictive ways in which sex categories regulate their lives. In the new book, The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution, Dr. Ann Travers talks to children ages 4 to 20 about the difficulties of growing up trans and the challenges that parents can face. Ann Travers is an associate professor of sociology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. I asked why they wanted to tell this story.
Well, I grew up as a gender nonconforming kid in a really inhospitable social environment. So I have always been rather painfully aware of the way in which people impose gender norms on kids, and it's bugged me. When I became a parent and I started moving through spaces, you know, with children and families, I tried very hard, just as a good feminist, to keep people from telling my kids who they were on the basis of the, you know, their sex category. And it was so difficult. I realized that there had been very little progress since when I was a kid, and I started to think about kids like me, and I started looking into it. You know, then I realized that not only are gender norms harmful for all kids, but they put trans kids in crisis.
You say that there's been very little progress. That's actually probably true, but 10 years ago, were we even having this conversation?
We were just starting to. There was an increase in the visibility of transgender people and, you know, the beginning of a change in the conversation from shame and deviance to, you know, normalcy and pride. But the thing is, when I was a kid, one lucky feature was I was born in the 60s, so I grew up in the 70s, and unisex fashion was the norm. So I wasn't forced to pick which aisle to shop from then, you know. Everybody wore jeans and T-shirts, and jeans and T-shirts came from the same store. They weren't sex-divided. So there was an advantage in that, whereas now it's crazy. You go into a kid's toy store or a clothing store, and you're literally dealing with different sides of the store. Clothes are coded in terms of gender in a way that, you know, a little girl wearing a T-shirt and jeans, if they're not from the girls' section, is going to get comments from other kids.
Well, let's talk about the kids. Where did you find the students and the parents who you ended up talking to for the book?
I started attending conferences for trans kids and their families, so I met some through there. But also, as word of my research started to get around, I often became a point of contact for parents whose kids had just told them they were trans, and they would often contact me for resources, which I really welcomed. So as I got to know parents who were looking for resources, sometimes I was able to interview them. But I also met some trans kids, you know, teens, on Facebook groups, and I also was able to reach out to some parents of trans kids on Facebook groups. But, you know, in the sociology business, we call it snowball sampling, too. You meet one person, and you interview them, and then you ask them, could you pass my information on to anybody else who you think might have something to say, and ask them if they might be willing to call me. So I got a lot of contacts that way, through word of mouth.
Did you find in your research that geography, where somebody lives, might make it either harder or easier to bring up a trans child?
Definitely, but not in the sense that there are, you know, any hard and fast rules. There were some kids who lived in rural environments who were very accepted, and some kids who lived in large urban areas who had a lot more trouble. It's really hard to predict. One of the things we know is that the most important element for the well-being of trans kids is family acceptance. If they have family acceptance and they feel like they're not fighting alone, that's a huge factor that increases their, you know, likelihood of survival, literally. Whereas they could be in a very progressive area, but if their parents aren't supportive, then, you know, they really struggle.
How do parents learn gender acceptance?
Well, I had sort of two different kinds of parents that I interviewed, and they were all supportive of their trans kids. I didn't speak to anyone who wasn't supportive of their trans kids. You know, one group were people who had a feminist understanding of gender in the first place. So they were working very hard to let their children be who they were, regardless of what sex they were assigned at birth. But, you know, these folks too were a bit surprised when their kids came out as trans, but they, you know, they got on board pretty fast and did research and learned how to advocate for their kids. Another group were folks who'd really never given gender any thought. But because they loved their kids and they believed that their kids were people who had some authority to speak about who they were, they responded to their kids. And they also noticed that their kid was really suffering if they were not being respected and recognized for the gender that they are. And they educated themselves pretty quickly. So both groups, you know, there was a little bit of adjustment involved, but because they're such good parents and they're so supportive of their kids, they made the adjustment quickly by educating themselves. And, you know, in both cases, parents like this have gone on to create resources for other parents of trans kids, to start organizations, to provide support for trans teens in their area, and they've also reached out to trans adults.
Kind of sounds like as the children were developing what gender they were going to be, the parents were like maybe one step behind them learning too.
Sure. And I mean, I think the thing that they did right, and again, it, you know, sometimes there was a little bit of, you know, whoa, what's happening? But the thing that they did right was they followed their kids' lead. They understood that this is not something that they could ignore, that this is really important to their kid. This is who their kid is, and they need to get on board. And they followed their children's lead in this regard and just learned to support and treat them in keeping with who they said they are.
You said you did not speak to any parents who were not supportive of their children. Did you speak to kids who did have parents, though, that didn't support them?
Yeah, I did. I had one kid who told his parents he was trans right after he graduated from high school. They told him he was an abomination and kicked him out of the house. And you could tell, like when I interviewed him, I could tell how much damage that did to him and how hurtful it was. He wasn't surprised because his parents were very conservative Christians, but it hurt him deeply. There were other kids whose parents sort of went back and forth, who were somewhat supportive but would keep using the wrong pronoun, and that was very difficult for them. There was another kid who left home because his father couldn't support him. I mean, one of the things we know is that LGBT kids constitute a disproportionate number of homeless and street youth because their families are often unsafe places for them. And the kids that I talked to whose families didn't support them were deeply hurt by it, and they really struggled.
This might be a question that also changed in the past 10 years, but how are schools and school districts starting to deal with this?
Well, it really varies from school district to school district. In Canada, there are a number of school boards that have adopted trans-inclusive policies that require the school to respect the child's pronoun and affirmed name, to treat them in accordance with the gender that they are rather than what it says on their birth certificate. So that's been positive.
Is that all throughout Canada? That's a national law?
No, it isn't. Oh. There are different policies in, I think there are four provinces, British Columbia, Ontario, Manitoba, and I'm gapping on what the fourth one is right now. Oh, I think it's Alberta, where kids are accepted for the gender that they say they are. The state of California has a law that requires that trans kids be respected for who they are. But, you know, these policies are incredibly important, but they're unevenly applied as well. And one of the things that it's really important to keep in mind is that the majority of trans kids are invisible because they don't feel safe to show themselves. And even in school districts that have trans-inclusive policies, they're still very much organized around the two-sex system. So kids are still... It's not unusual for teachers to talk about, you know, girls being like this, boys being like this, sometimes dividing kids according to sex for activities. Physical education classes are divided. So for trans kids who don't fit with either side of the binary, or for trans kids who are invisible because they don't feel they have enough support to show themselves, these sex-segregated and sex-differentiated environments put them in crisis. So one of the most important ways that we can support all trans kids is by avoiding organizing children according to sex category, because that way it creates room for all kids, but it also removes the sense of crisis that the trans kids, both visible and invisible, experience on a daily basis.
Okay, I'm going to hit you with the argument you've heard 1,000 times. We have 500 kids in this school. Why should we change everything for those two over there?
Well, because it benefits everybody. We know that the whole emphasis on boys being boys and girls being girls doesn't happen in a neutral context. It happens in a context where men have more cultural and material resources than women do. And this is unhealthy for everybody. Equality is a positive thing. So if we spend less time emphasizing sex difference, this creates more room for all kids. Also, like I said, the majority of trans kids are invisible, so we have no idea how many children we're harming when we impose sex categories on kids.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Ann Travers continues with a look at creating a safe space in schools for trans students. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Ann Travers, an associate professor of sociology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. We're talking about their new book called The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. We talked about the inevitability of bullying in school and how to protect these students.
Well, I think it's our job as adults to create environments that are safe for children. One of the things that major studies have found into the experiences of LGBT kids is it's not just other kids, their peers, who bully them. It's often teachers who make negative comments. So this is a problem with the whole school culture. And I think that if we start talking about gender as an open-ended system and work very hard to create accepting environments for LGBT people of all ages, kids can adjust. We don't accept racist bullying, So why should we accept sexist and transphobic and homophobic bullying? Most of the time, this kind of behavior happens with the support, or at least the, you know, the neutrality of adults in positions of authority. Kids catch on really fast. Often parents told me that the brothers or sisters of their trans kid adjusted much faster than the adults in the family. Children can be taught to respect each other and to be kind.
You talked about how some kids in school are invisible. What, and they're leading a double life. What does leading that double life do to a child's development, if anything?
It's incredibly harmful for their self-esteem because they feel like who they really are is not okay. So there's a lot of shame and self-hatred that gets inculcated by that experience. You know, they're getting the message that they don't belong, that they need to change in order to fit in. And, you know, the mental health consequences are very negative. Trans kids are disproportionately likely to engage in self-harm and suicide attempts. And sometimes we know that a trans kid commits suicide, but often parents learned that their kid was trans as a result of an unsuccessful suicide attempt. So for it to get that bad, that's really awful. For a kid to be feeling that bad, it speaks to how harmful it is that environments are not welcoming to kids whose gender identities are not traditional.
We talked about geography. Let's talk about economics. Does poverty have a factor in how a child develops, either healthy or non-healthy in this way?
It limits the resources that parents have to advocate for a child. And we know that in the United States and Canada, to a considerable extent, poverty is racialized, meaning that Black and Native Americans and Black and Indigenous Canadians are disproportionately likely to be poor. So it doesn't mean that, you know, families from poor backgrounds or racialized families are less accepting of trans kids, because they're not. I mean, you have quite a range across all socioeconomic categories. There are some accepting families and some not accepting families. But imagine being a single parent working a full-time job and not having the ability to take time off from work to meet with your child's school, or not having the familiarity with the way school systems work to work with the school to create an environment that is welcoming to your child. Wealthier parents have access to lawyers, etc. You know, they have a lot more access to resources. Even though the American Civil Liberties Union has taken a leading role in supporting trans kids, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights has taken on an advocacy role, just the ability to reach out to organizations like this to know that resources like this exist, that's unevenly distributed. Also, parents, you know, who are poor or racialized, they're not just dealing with transphobia, they're also dealing with racism, with poverty. So the more complexity that somebody is having to deal with, the harder things are.
I did want to bring this up, of course. In the last election, we had, my note here says, bathroom hysteria. There was the rash of bathroom bills being passed around the country, specifically targeting trans children, and in fact, all trans people. Did that actually help because it started a conversation, or was it just as disgusting as it sounded?
Well, it's just as disgusting as it started. And imagine being, you know, one of those invisible trans kids who has no support and hearing that people hate you. Even if a lot of people thought the bathroom bills are wrong, just to hear that people hate you and think that you're evil, I mean, it's so cruel. It's especially cruel because it's trans people who are at risk in bathrooms. Trans people are not dangerous to other people. I mean, imagine being unable to use a bathroom in a public space because you were made to feel unwelcome there. That's a pretty debilitating social experience. For someone who's unable to pass in their gender category, someone who is read as transgender or gender nonconforming, going to the bathroom is like a big deal. And one of the things we find is that many, many trans kids hold their pee all day. They won't go to the bathroom because they don't feel safe going to the bathroom. And you can imagine the negative health results that come from not using the bathroom when you need to use the bathroom. But I just think that hearing people speaking about trans people in such a cruel and unkind way is terrible for self-esteem. And conversely, we know that states where same-sex marriage rights exist, queer and trans kids have higher self-esteem. So the more that, you know, there are public statements in support of LGBT people, the better off trans kids are. And conversely, in states where there are anti-trans bathroom bills and, you know, there are a lot of negative public comments about trans and gay people, it's incredibly harmful.
Well, I'll ask one final question. Look ahead. Things getting better? You optimistic?
In some ways, I'm optimistic because trans people are more and more visible. But at the same time, the election in the United States, et cetera, is very concerning. In Ontario, which is one of the largest provinces in Canada, there's been a recent conservative shift. The premier who is elected is repealing trans-inclusive and pro-LGBT sex ed curriculum, and measures like this, and measures for mental health support for young people, etc. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. There are definitely more allies for trans people of all ages than there have been in the past. At the same time, there are very concerted campaigns to limit the rights that trans people have, so I'm quite concerned.
Again, the name of Ann Travers' new book is The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. It's published by NYU Press. So how does the American public at large feel about the issue of transgender rights? Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Could unfamiliarity with transgender people be driving negative attitudes in the U.S.? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Dan Lewis, associate professor of political science at Siena College, examines this question.
Voters in Anchorage recently rejected a transgender bathroom bill, which would have required transgender people to use public facilities that match the sex on their birth certificates. That vote came on the heels of President Trump's order to bar transgender people from the military and high-profile referendums in Houston and Fayetteville, where voters rejected efforts to protect transgender people from discrimination in public accommodations. As a relatively new issue that directly affects only a small minority of Americans, it is not clear how the public has formed opinions on these policy proposals. To find out, a team of political scientists conducted three of the first national surveys on transgender rights. Though transgender rights are often lumped in with LGBT rights, striking differences were found in attitudes towards the two groups. In general, support for policies that protect transgender rights is lower compared to similar policies that address gay rights. Also, attitudes towards transgender people tend to be more influenced by partisanship and gender, and less influenced by religiosity compared to attitudes towards gay men and lesbians. The surveys also revealed that roughly a third of Americans are unable or unwilling to report a position on most policies, reflecting considerable uncertainty about the issue. These attitudes may derive simply from unfamiliarity. 2 years ago, just 15% of Americans reported knowing someone who is transgender, compared to 58% that know someone who is gay. This is important because knowing an LGBT person significantly increases positive attitudes towards the groups as a whole. Further, the study found that simply showing a picture of someone who is transgender, regardless of how the person looked, increased support for transgender rights. This suggests that public attitudes may become more accepting in the future as Americans become more familiar with the concept of transgender identities and transgender people themselves.
That was Dan Lewis of Siena College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.